Programming is supported by Topline Construction Firm, your local women-owned roofing contractor based out of Shoreview, Minnesota. Roof replacement, both retail and insurance work. More information at toplineconstructionfirm.com.
You're listening to a recording of a live radio show on NPR News. If you want to listen to us in real time, you can stream our show live weekdays at 9 and 11 a.m. Central. Thanks for listening and enjoy the show.
You're listening to NPR News. I'm Marianne Combs. This hour, we're going to talk about the persistent lack of diversity in the nation's newsrooms. 50 years ago, President Lyndon B. Johnson formed a commission to examine the causes of the 1967 race riots. One of its top findings? The news media failed to analyze and report adequately on racial problems in the United States. The commission pointed specifically at a lack of diversity in newsrooms as being a major part of the problem. Unfortunately, today, the situation hasn't significantly improved. Major newsrooms across the country, including our own here at Minnesota Public Radio, still fail to reflect the communities they serve. This despite the fact that our country is rapidly diversifying. So, why do newsrooms continue to lag behind? And what can we learn from those newsrooms who have managed to make significant strides? I, of course, want to hear from you. Do you feel the media does a good job of covering your community? What is it missing? What stories would you like to hear? Give us a call, 651-227-6000 or 1-800-242-2828. Joining me this hour from Washington, D.C. is Luis Clemens, Senior Editor for Diversity at NPR News. Luis, thanks so much for joining us this morning.
Great to be here.
And we're also joined by Alicia Williams Boyd, Senior Digital Director for USA Today Network in New Jersey and Asbury Park Press. Alicia, welcome. Thanks for joining us this morning.
Thank you so much. Excited to be here as well.
First, to you, Luis, why is diversity such a persistent problem in the media?
Look, what we've learned over the last few decades is that people like to talk to people like themselves. We've found in our research that white reporters overwhelmingly speak to white sources, that Latino reporters speak overwhelmingly to Latino sources, and on and on, and men tend to speak with other men. I think it boils down to we as journalists really have to fight to get outside of our natural comfort zone, and that you compare newsrooms to other institutions, and newsrooms may be doing better than most.
Really? You think newsrooms are doing better than most?
Oh, yeah, sure. I mean, look at Congress. Look at state legislatures. Look at halls of power and cities and towns across the country. Sure. I mean, we have a persistent problem throughout American society. We have far, less than equal representation in terms of gender at the executive level. Heads of Fortune 500 companies, sure. I think this is a persistent and significant problem across American society. Yeah. I think as newsrooms, we're really visible, and we're actually more transparent about it than most.
Newsrooms are also very good at calling out others on their lack of diversity. But it seems like in recent years, there's been an eye towards covering our own lack of diversity, of saying, okay, it's true, we can't just cover other people's problems. We have these problems as well internally. You're talking about at National Public Radio, you have an ombudsman who talks about this. New York Times is also covering its own issues around diversity.
We have no choice but to do so. I mean, as you say, if we are in a position of calling others out, we have to make sure that we're transparent about what our own situation is.
Mm-hmm. Alicia, what do you think? What for you are the persistent or the sort of the problems, the hurdles that newsrooms face in addressing their own lack of diversity?
I think right now, when you think about the dwindling resources that we're faced with right now, I think when you think about the challenges that we have in terms of, kind of our new value of metrics and making sure that We're bringing in and engaging audiences and bringing in those page views. I think, you know, some of the focus may have shifted away from bringing in diverse hires, creating those pipelines that we need to create. And one thing I think that we've possibly fallen short to some degree in realizing is that when we bring in those hires, when we bring in those staffers that have a diverse perspective, that's the way we're going to reach some of the audiences that we haven't been able to reach over the years. That's the way that we engage those folks. We have research that shows that our audiences want to see themselves reflected in content. There's a term, symbolic annihilation, which is the idea that if you don't see people like you in the media you consume, you're somehow unimportant. So when we're thinking about, you know, how representation matters, those are the things that we should be prioritizing, creating more diverse newsrooms, getting a broad array of perspectives into our rooms. And I think the focus has started to change. You have folks like Luis who, you know, are so dedicated to the cause, new positions that are being created every day to help cultivate that. So I think I think we are moving potentially in the right direction. I at least see it here in my own newsroom. Mm-hmm. But, you know, we obviously have a long way to go.
Yeah. Ashley, talk a little bit about your newsroom. And it stands out as a newsroom that has done a better job of reflecting the community it serves. Talk about how that happened.
Absolutely. I mean, we've really made it a focus to pull in reporters who are looking at the world through different sets of lenses, who are bringing different experiences to the table. Those differences in background, again, lead to better balanced content, better informed journalism. Those differences in experiences help to keep your publication from being predictable and from being biased. You need people on your team who are going to hear the dog whistle when it sounds. So we've done quite a few things here under the leadership of my editor, Hollis Towns, who unfortunately couldn't be available for the interview today. But, when the press circulates across two counties, 1.2 million people, a large portion of those folks are white, but we do have towns in our coverage area that we're nearly 70% are people of color. And when Hollis took the helm of the press, this is a little under a decade ago, one of his first acts was to try to identify like inequalities in the area and figure out how we're going to correct them. We ended the abusive use of police mugshots that stereotype minorities. We had nearly all white police forces in both counties who would routinely release arrest photos of minorities caught in drug stings and horrific crimes, but they never presented photos of white suspects who posted bail or were involved in white collar crimes. And we really used the bully pulpit or the press to demand that police release all suspect photos. And when there was resistance, we took this to the public. You know, we really made a transparent public statement that if no mugshots were released, every story would end with, you know, the press requested a photo of the suspect, but police declined to provide one. And that pressure eventually convinced several departments to change their ways. Ocean County quietly began to post mugshots on the county jail website. So, you know, those were just a few things that I think we've been able to do that maybe someone who was less sensitive to some of the differences and the disparities might not have picked up on. A leadership team that was not as in tune with what might be the biases in coverage and in even in information release from local law enforcement possibly may not have picked up on. It hadn't been picked up on for years. So, I think we've been successful in hiring minority management. Mm-hmm. You know, it's not just about hiring staff, and filling a seat. We have a reporter that we need to get in here, make sure that they're a reporter of color. We've also been really successful at elevating and developing staffers of color to make sure that they are moving into management and leadership positions and the kinds of positions that make the decisions, you know, in our news coverage. We've got three top-tier editors in Asbury of color and women in key positions. Our leadership team
That's
is
fabulous.
44, our leadership team is 44% women, 33% minority. Our newsroom as a whole is 25% minority. So we've really been able to make some gains. Again, everyone has, you know, growth, there's development to be made, but we're really proud of the work we've been able to do here thus far.
Thanks, Alicia. Luis, let's talk a little bit about the numbers at National Public Radio in terms of what diversity looks like there.
Well, not good enough. In terms of the newsroom, it's 75% white, or was 75% white as of last year, the last time we did the numbers. 25% combination people of color. Perhaps the weakest point within that is the number of Latino employees, and that's at 6%. So it's not a good number, and we have been working hard to increase that number and do so from both the pipeline that Alicia was referring to, everything from interns to fellows, all the way to people who are in the middle of their career and at the top of their game.
Yeah, and you know, Alicia mentioned resources, and that you know this is something that takes consistent time and attention and resources. That's not new. That's not, you know, stunning and surprising information. So why have newsrooms failed to give it the time and attention it deserves?
Look, I think when you consider the mindset of a newsroom, we are driven by what is happening now. And I think where many newsrooms fall down is we fail to look, step back and say, okay, where are we not reflecting the changes that are happening in the world, the changes that we are covering every day? I think you mentioned not just resources, but attention and time. We have enough time to do this. We have enough resources. We need to devote the attention is what it boils down to.
Mm.
And it's just, you know, sadly, one of those things that people keep thinking about, people keep pushing, trying different things. And unless you have sort of across-the-board newsroom attention and focus, it doesn't happen as fast as certainly I would like.
Mm. We're talking this hour about diversity in newsrooms, or I should say the lack of diversity in newsrooms, and it's the persistent problem over the years to diversify and reflect the communities that that newspapers and radio stations serve across the country. If you'd like to join the conversation, love to hear from you. Do you feel the media does a good job of covering your community? If not, what is it missing? What stories would you like to hear? Love to hear from you. Give us a call at 651-227-6000 or 1-800-242-2828. Let's go to Martin in Minneapolis. Martin, welcome to the conversation.
Hi, welcome. The thing I was going to bring up was talking about how diversifying spaces or representation is a way of addressing racial issues and white supremacy that news media tends to lean towards. And I don't think like with an agenda or anything, it just kind of happens by where resources are and who's occupying space of power. And I think your guess of addressed, like, I was like, oh, how does that work? And hearing like how bringing in people of diversity are pushing for certain issues, and by bringing in people of management is like a way that these stories can get through. But I guess that the way that the conversation was framed at the beginning to me seemed a little didn't seem to hit the whole picture, but like representation is what it needs to address racism, because I think that there's like the effects of internalized racism and
absolutely
that representation. Like, I myself am like Mexican, but I think like the stories that affect me, you know, it's like that it's not just like representation of how you look that's really going to hit the stories. And I think that there's like the issues of where the funding comes for, like, where's the resources, who has the money, how do these organizations run. I think that like there's like larger issues, and representation I think oftentimes is like
yeah,
the shortest kind of thing that can be done.
Martin, I think you've hit the nail on the head, and there's a bunch of stuff still to come here. We're just beginning the conversation, so we're going to take on some of those issues as the hour plays out. But you've raised a really good point. Ashley, what do you think about this notion of putting all your diversity hiring eggs in one basket? In other words, you're expecting a few people to carry the burden of diversity and coverage of race for the entire organization. Is this a common problem?
I would say it does happen, you know, when you have an LGBTQ issue that comes up. We know we have an editor who has that background that we want to make a part of that conversation. You know, same thing for people of color. We want to make sure that they're a part of that conversation. But one of the things that I think we've also been really careful to do is to pay attention to just, you know, at least in our own newsroom, is to not just pay attention to
racial diversity, but also be looking at socioeconomic diversity, people who did not go to elite schools, and as well as those who did, a diversity of religion, those with different political philosophies. We've seen that work in our newsroom. I can remember a story from one news organization that had literally been kind of embedded in the Midwest and talking to people in Middle America and, you know, having those conversations prior to Trump's election. And, you know, they had really embedded and taken the time to have those conversations. They sent reporters that would really cultivate the kind of trust that the folks that they were speaking to needed to be able to speak frankly. And they had already kind of had their finger on the pulse of the fact that, you know, this election could go a different way than everyone is thinking that it could go. So I think not necessarily just focusing on having that one person as a representative, but making sure that we bring a diversity of voices to the table is what really can help us to not have that, you know, putting your eggs all in one basket mentality. The Black reporter must cover this story, but bringing a diverse group of voices to the table is what's important.
Right. So you have the people at the table who can provide a mix of ideas and reactions to information or story ideas, but you don't constantly rely on the same person to, you know, say, well, this is your identity, therefore this is your beat.
Exactly. 100%.
Luis Clemens, what do you think about the notion of, I mean, do newsrooms fail to confront their own implicit bias and say, well, we'll just hire this problem out, you know, hire this a solution to this problem rather than actually taking a look at what we're thinking and how we're approaching a subject?
So we just finished a round of implicit bias training here at the newsroom and NPR just coincidentally within the last month. So, I mean, people have been addressing this issue head on. I want to address something that the caller mentioned, Martin, if I could.
Sure.
He spoke about this notion of representation sort of being the first step. And I want to echo that. It is necessary, but not sufficient. And I like to think of it as a first step. But when you address the notion of the burden of diversity, of the Latino reporter feeling that they have to cover Latino issues or be the go-to source on questions in the newsroom and whatnot. Look, I have been in that position for more than 25 years, and very early on, I chose to embrace it. And I chose to take the notion that, look, I'm part of this community. I want better understanding and better reporting on this story. But at the same time, I want to make sure that every Latino and Latina reporter out there does not feel that same responsibility. I want that Latino reporter who wants to be a classical music critic to, you know, just go and do that and not feel any sense of obligation to be covering her respect of her community. Does mm-hmm. that make sense?
Absolutely. Let's go back to the phones. We've got Deborah on the line in St. Paul. Deborah, welcome to the program.
Hi. What I think is at the root of the problem is white men feel they are entitled to power and entitled to being in charge. And they're going to, you know, that whatever institution it is, academia, the church, media, and they have been in charge, and they're going to want to stay in charge, and they're going to do what they can to be in charge, and probably a little lip service here and there. But as someone said with women, you know, the whole pipeline thing, is they said with women, the pipeline is clogged with mediocre men, and I would say mediocre white men.
Hmm.
It's their entitlement.
All right, Deborah, thank you for that call. Alicia, what do you think?
I would just say that, you know, that's where having, you know, and I know we say that there's more than just representation involved, but having people with different perspectives in those leadership positions can really help to change the tide of that. I think previously we kind of got stuck in this cycle where things did not change, where we didn't see any significant shift. And we're still there, but we're making incremental steps, I do believe. And now that we've got folks in that pipeline that we talk about, when we've got folks moving into management and leadership positions, we can make better decisions about who we continue to move up and who we continue to advance and move forward. I can remember, as a reporter, more than a decade ago, not really having any particular ambitions toward management, but I did kind of have my father worked for a technology company. He was an accountant, but he always kind of got the tools and the devices and brought things home early. So I had a lot of the behaviors of someone who was like a tech native. And when I got into the position as a young reporter, I immediately saw that Twitter was going to be something, a way to reach audiences. I immediately saw that social was going to be a way that we could connect with folks outside of the newsroom and outside of our normal audience that we would reach in our print publications. And having an editor of color in a higher leadership position, he was able to see, this was way back when folks in the newsroom were still saying, hey, what are you doing on Twitter telling people what you ate for breakfast? And, they didn't quite get it yet, but he was kind of able to see, like, hey, there's somebody who is thinking ahead and is thinking forward. And he didn't move me into a management position per se, but he moved me into kind of a position to champion social for the newsroom. And that was kind of where my steps forward into leadership and management began. So I do think that is a very important first step.
Mm. Luis, you often hear complaints from managers saying, well, it's just a struggle to find the talent. There are just not that many great, diverse candidates out there. Is that even an acceptable excuse anymore? And what are the barriers that you still face in recruiting diverse talent?
So as far as NPR goes, and I think broadly as far as public radio goes, it's a lack of awareness. Look, I was a reporter for 20 years before I learned of NPR, and that was only because I'd been invited to be a guest the following day. I grew up in Miami where I listened to Spanish language radio. I did not know such a thing as public radio existed. So I think really it's more about getting our message as individual newsrooms out to interested journalists. No, I don't think it's acceptable to say there are not enough people out there, because there are. You have to work hard to identify people, and you have to work hard to promote yourself as well.
Mm-hmm. And then in terms of once you've recruited the staff, I think a challenge that we faced here at NPR News and other newsrooms have found is retaining the talent that you've hired, creating an environment where they want to stay and work. And what do you see as being some of the bigger challenges to creating a place where diverse staff feel like, yep, my voice is appreciated here, I'm heard here, there's a career path for me here?
So there's almost this very difficult step in the transition to getting a fully diverse newsroom, where until there are a certain number of people like you around you, you're not sure the newsroom is all in. You're not sure the organization is fully committed. It's almost like you have to already be succeeding in order to be retaining people. Hmm. But along that step, as you're increasing diversity, you can work hard and work with individuals to really reinforce that level of support around them and make sure that the ways they feel the newsroom needs to change to better embrace difference, better embrace people of color, better embrace people with different viewpoints, that those changes are taken into account and considered and in some occasions implemented.
We're talking this hour about diversity in newsrooms and what needs to change so that newsrooms across the country reflect the communities they serve, what's important about reflecting those communities that we serve. It's a problem we've wrestled with here at Minnesota Public Radio, and one of the things we've realized is we need to reach out to students from diverse communities to tell them about public radio early on so that we're on their radio when they start looking for on their radar when they start looking for internships and possible career paths. To that end, we created Radio Camp, a collaboration with local nonprofit 360 Journalism. This summer, 8 students came to NPR News to learn the basics of what we do: field recording, interviewing, writing stories, and voicing their own scripts. And we thought you might like to hear one of their stories. Radio Camp reporter Aaliyah Demery interviewed Guthrie Theater's artistic director, Joseph Hodge. The big summer musical at the Guthrie Theater this year is a revival of West Side Story. It's a play about love, violence, and the immigrant experience in America. Demery found out director Joseph Hodge knows firsthand what that experience is like.
I've waited decades to direct this play. I've wanted to direct it forever.
Hodge was raised in Miami. He's the middle child, the second of 3 boys. His parents were Palestinian immigrants. They lived in a lower middle class neighborhood with few opportunities.
You know, it's funny that I ended up in the career that I was in, because there was just zero exposure to arts of any kind. Like, we just didn't have anything.
Hodge's family faced a culture shock. His parents didn't know how to teach him about fitting in with American culture.
It's like, oh, you're going to a birthday party. This is what you wear to a birthday party. You're going to a baseball game. This is what you do when you go to, like, my parents didn't know what a birthday party or a baseball game was. Like, didn't even know. How was it 8th grade? And every kid in class seems to know that painter pants were the pants to buy. Like, how did I not get this memo? You know, so, like, you know, the whole sense of sort of a cultural displacement is real.
That's why Hodge knows what the characters in the West Side Story are going through.
There are themes in the play, especially around immigrant experience, that just make so much sense to me that I understand very deeply.
I like to be in America. Okay, by me in America.
Like, you know, you think of the song, if you know West Side Story at all, you think of a song like America, where one person is singing about, oh, wistfully wanting to go back to Puerto Rico.
I like the city of San Juan. I
know. And then there's another character who's like, are you crazy? I wouldn't go back there for anything.
Hundreds of people in each room.
That conversation happened in my parents' living room all growing up. Other Arabs in Miami would be in there, and they'd have this conversation. Half of the group wistful for the home country and wanting to go back. And then people like my mom going, are you crazy? Like, I wouldn't go back for anything.
If you could compare your personality with any of the characters, which one would you pick?
Oh my God, that's the best question. I think there are parts of my personality that's like this part of action, this part of Riff, this part of Doc, to be sure, this part of Anita. I don't think there's any one character I really, really, really tune to most. Maybe Riff. Maybe Riff.
Riff is not an immigrant. Like Joseph Hodge, he was born in America. Hodge sees the character as smart, but with a lot of barriers in his way. And he sees some of those same traits in himself. From Minnesota Public Radio News and 360 Journalism, I'm Aaliyah Demery.
Aaliyah Demery is one of 8 teenagers who participated in this summer's radio camp at Minnesota Public Radio. I should note that this project with 360 Journalism was created to honor the legacy of Tony Randolph, a longtime NPR news journalist and champion of 360's work. Tony believed newsrooms should reflect the diversity of the communities they serve. But as we've noted this hour, most major newsrooms fail to do so. My guests this hour are Luis Clemens, senior editor for diversity at NPR News, and Alicia Williams-Boyd with Asbury Park Press. You can also join the conversation. Give us a call at 651-227-6000 or 1-800-242-2828. So, Alicia, what can newsrooms do so that when Aaliyah decides she's ready to pursue journalism, will be a place where she can make a career for herself?
I would say, and this kind of goes back to fostering that faith and belief within your staff that your organization is an organization that's committed to diversity. And part of that is programs just like the program that she's involved in. We here in Asbury, we partner with a program, the Hugh Boyd Diversity and Journalism Workshop, no relation, but we've worked for years with programs like the Diversity and Journalism Workshop, where diverse students from throughout the state are spending 2 weeks at a camp. This year it's being held at Rutgers University. They come into the newsroom, learn how to put together a digital publication, learn how to produce their own video, and spend the day in our newsroom hearing from journalists. they're learning about, you know, journalists' experiences who look just like them firsthand. They're developing mentorship relationships. So important. Programs like the Student Project Program at the National Association of Black Journalists, the Asian American Journalists Association's J-Camp for high schoolers. Mm-hmm. There's so many different programs, the MetPro program at Los Angeles Times and the Chicago Tribune. So many different programs that kind of cultivate that, not only for the students, but reinforcing the staff's belief that, you know, this is something that my company is committed to. My favorite thing in the world is when the Journalism Workshop is here in our offices during the summer, and I have more reporters than we will actually have time for them to connect with, volunteering to be a part of that conversation because they're so excited that we're involved in that. Yeah, it's fantastic. Another thing I would say that we should look to do is to look outside of our newsrooms. I was actually very privileged to be a part of a leadership committee that has been working on digital, you know, plans for digital advancement and development going, you know, in the year to come. And a big part of that conversation was, how do we attract a more diverse audience? How do we attract a more diverse staff? And one of the first ideas that came up from one of my brilliant colleagues was, you know, we should look outside of our newsrooms. And it's something that we've been doing in terms of content, looking at not just what other newspapers are doing, but looking at what all types of media and all types of businesses are doing across the spectrum, and taking a page from companies who, and not just media companies, but taking a page from those companies who have successfully integrated diversity and inclusion in their operations, looking at the list of America's best employers for diversity. Cisco Systems was ranked as one of the 7 most diverse and inclusive companies in the U.S., by U.S. Insider. They required all managers to read Sheryl Sandberg's Lean In and worked with the Hispanic IT Executive Council and the Society of Women Engineers to hire more underrepresented minorities and women. And I think we should do more of that. We should be partnering with organizations that can help us expand. We've had challenges. We've had struggles with drawing diverse hires and drawing diverse staff. So can we look for strategic partnerships with organizations that have already mastered that? You know, can we, you know, add diversity and inclusion expertise to our wish list that way? We don't have to reinvent the wheel. We're struggling with it. These are organizations that have done it well. How can we tap into what they know and what they've been able to do, with those types of organizations?
Louise Clemens, you mentioned that NPR just went through a massive implicit bias training. I'm wondering, you know, one of our callers mentioned just the resistance of white males to cede power to other groups. And there is this sense of, even if we check all the boxes on the list of things you should do to have a diverse newsroom, if there isn't a true desire and appetite for diversity and an appreciation for its benefits, aren't all those efforts going to fall flat? So I'm curious, what did your implicit bias training reveal? How did it go?
Well, can I backtrack for a second?
Of because course you can.
What the caller mentioned about the entrenchment of white men and mediocrity that she referred to and whatnot. Look, in my experience, there is no shortage of willingness to embrace diversity in journalism. Why? Because we are journalists and we appreciate what that more diversity in terms of representation, in terms of viewpoints, in terms of talking to a broader range of people results in better journalism. I think what we fight every day, each of us, is habit and the status quo and the same way of doing things, which not surprisingly ends up with similar results. So I think it's not some internal power struggle. I mean, everyone in every newsroom where I've worked loves journalism and wants to get better at creating news that is consumed by as many people as possible.
But this has been 50 years in the making, Louise, 50 years, and we haven't made much progress.
Well, I would challenge that notion of not having made much progress. I mean, for instance, when we look at the issue of gender, I mean, NPR's newsroom is 56% women. The heads of all the major news magazines are women. We have had senior vice presidents of news. I mean, look, I'm not satisfied with the degree of progress, but there is movement. And if we don't recognize that we are moving or have moved over those 50 years, it's a very different situation than when I started out more than 25 years ago.
Hmm. Okay. So, still, I'm going to ask, how did that implicit bias training go?
Look, everyone is I've had variations of this before. Everyone is confronted with dirty truths about themselves that they jump to conclusions. We have this lizard part of our brain that just acts automatically and that takes in the accumulated detritus and crud of bad messages and bad thoughts and stereotypes that accumulate over the course of decades. So the notion of you really have to actively combat that and be aware of what your biases are. And part of what you do is talk to colleagues and talk to an expanded group of people outside the newsroom and reach out and figure out what you are not covering. Figure out where the blind spots are.
We're talking about diversity in newsrooms. Let's go to the phones. We've got Mark on the line in St. Paul. Mark, welcome to the conversation. Hello there.
Yeah, hi. Thanks for having me on.
Sure thing.
So I'm glad you brought in education recently into the conversation, as I'm a teacher myself. And I just want to go back to the point of finding quality candidates and how hard that may seem to others. And I want to talk about that point you made on habit. Well, I believe that, you know, the way in which we hire candidates and the way in which we look for certain features of candidates is born and bred out of white male culture. The best example I have comes from my career in teaching, in which the students that we often see as finding themselves in troubling situations and find themselves in the pipeline to the prison system is minority students. And I know as a teacher, the reason for this has nothing to do with the quality of students sitting in front of me. They have a lot of potential. It just has to do with the system in which they're growing up in, which happens to be a white male system. And so I think that if we look, so as a teacher, I need to adjust the way in which I teach. And I think that I need to adjust the way in which I see my students. I think the same applies for finding job applicants, including in the news media.
Mm-hmm. All right. Alicia, what do you think?
I agree with what the caller is saying. To that point, to Lisa's point, you know, unconscious bias does play such a significant factor in some of the decisions that we make in news coverage. You know, even job postings having hidden bias, even having an internship program where the interns are not paid and minority students don't necessarily have that option to be able to work without being paid for, you know, however long a student that's more affluent or has more opportunities is able to do. So taking a really hard, close look at, you know, those things that we really may take for granted and just do reflexively because it's always been done is so critical, you know, just kind of blowing that up. I can remember in Facebook comments once, you know, when my current editor came on, seeing a message from a reader who said, is it just me or is the Asbury Park Press hiring lots of urban reporters who are really aggressive?
Urban aggressive reporters. You know, is that code for something?
That is code. That is the code. And it was so obviously the code. And, you know, but that person didn't even realize that, you know, or maybe they did. But, you know, it's just being able to kind of figure out those biases. And again, part of that, you know, part of blowing that up is making sure that we're making it a priority, making sure that we're having those conversations, making sure that we're developing training and developing, you know, committees to come up with strategic plans to help address all of those things.
Mm. Whitney in Moorhead writes, this is aggressive passive affirmative action, which is a form of discrimination. People are their thoughts, not their gender or race. Whitney has a point. I mean, Luis, nobody wants to be called and said, hey, we want to hire you because you're going to be that reporter that's going to make us more diverse, as opposed to we want to hire you because you're a great reporter.
I agree. But let's go back to the original comment from the caller for a second, because this notion that your thoughts are somehow separate from your experience and your experience in this country is somehow separate from your gender, from
identity.
How much you earned, where you live, where you grew up, your politics, et cetera, et cetera. I mean, there are a whole range of factors. So we're not talking about affirmative action here. We are talking about trying to represent inside the newsroom the range of experiences and lives that are lived in the country at large to better cover that country. That's the first thing. As far as, you know, being the person who ends up being asked to represent a specific community and cover a specific community, some of us are fine with that. Many are not.
Mm-hmm.
But I can tell you, I mean, no, it's not a great feeling to be on the receiving end of one of these calls that you think someone is making because you represent or part of a given group. There has to be a genuine commitment, an authentic sort of drive to get better at the diversity side of this, to get better at the journalism side, rather than, as you were alluding to earlier, just checking boxes.
Bill from Edina writes, I don't think it's practical to achieve full diversity in a newsroom, which is why there are different news outlets for different perspectives. I listen to NPR in the morning and Fox News at night in order to hear different sides of the conversation. What do you think of that? Alicia, what do you think of the idea that, you know, it's not practical to be a fully diverse newsroom?
I think it would be lovely if we could, you know, if that was not the case, if you didn't have to split your viewing choices just to make sure you're getting both sides of a story. And I think that that's what, you know, at least in our local newsrooms, we're aiming for every day, is to have truly authentic, fair and balanced reporting, you know, and just going back to the point about, you know, is this affirmative action? I can say on the leadership team here in New Jersey, we've got someone handling our video strategy who has worked for CNN, who's worked for NBC, who has, you know, really been involved in, you know, high level video production and has brought all of those talents here to the company. We've got a former attorney on staff who's worked in journalism as well. And our sites right now are some of the top performing in the company. So, you know, audiences are receiving, you know, what the work that we're doing, and you know, it is working. If it was not working, you know, there would be changes made, and there have been changes made. So I wouldn't necessarily, you know, I don't think we can paint diversity with, you know, that kind of a broad brush. I think it would be, you know, a failure on our part if we did.
Yeah. Luis, NPR recently fielded criticism for airing an interview with white nationalist Jason Kessler in advance of the Unite the Right rally in D.C. this past weekend. Critics said the interviewer didn't push back enough and essentially gave him a platform for his racist hate speech. But this was actually a very diverse staff that worked on that interview. So what's the lesson here? What's the takeaway?
Look, I wasn't involved directly in the production of this or in discussion around it. So I feel somewhat hemmed in by not knowing what happened behind the scenes. But knowing the people involved, I can assure listeners that a great deal of thought and discussion went into this. Does that mean when you have a great deal of thought and discussion that the right answer always comes out the other end? No. But it means the process is geared towards making that happen more often than not. And I will cite one of the people who was involved with it, Terry Samuel, who's our deputy managing editor, said, and that is, it's important to talk about race, and sometimes that means talking to racists.
Mm-hmm. Alicia, when a newsroom fails to represent its community in terms of its staffing, I mean, what are the consequences? What's being lost? I mean, I think it's important to remind people that this is not a bitter pill we're talking about. This is talking about, you know, something that's additive.
I think what you're losing is what most people, I would hope, come to our platforms for, which is, again, fair and balanced reporting, factual reporting, reporting that looks at all sides of a situation so that you, as the reader, as the audience, can make your own determinations and make your own decisions about the coverage that you're consuming. You know, I think part of trying to develop that trust with our audiences and develop the trust, again, going back to developing the trust with our staffs, is to be able to incorporate those diverse staffers. And we've had a handful of, you know, young, hungry minority journalists, a mix of Latino and African-American reporters and editors who have worked relentlessly on coverage of violence that was plaguing the west side of Asbury Park, our namesake city, a few years back, and the challenges that the school system faced that left them with a 50% graduation rate. You know, those reporters, you know, being reflective of the community that they were covering, were able to get access to stories, to get people and families in the community to open up to them in a way that they hadn't in years, and even to tell those stories in ways that were touching and compelling and in ways that reporters and editors before them had not. You know, so I just think, you know, and in addition to that, we didn't just stop at telling those stories. You know, a lot of these reporters and journalists here in the room are, you know, volunteers in the community that are like working to help solve problems. I think that also helps to try to build that trust and to make, you know, make yourselves and make your platforms a place where readers go to get the information, because they know that you're not just necessarily here to point out problems, but you also live here. You don't just work here. You live. You don't just parachute in. You live in this area. You're working to help solve problems, and it's about building that engagement and building that relationship and loyalty with the communities that you cover.
You mentioned the 2016 elections earlier. Do you think that the lack of diverse staffing played into newsrooms being blindsided by Donald Trump's win?
I don't know, Luis. Did you want to take that or?
Sure, I could take it. Look, I think, you know, without covering the White House beat, I can't say for sure. And I can't say because I've covered previous presidential campaigns, but not this one. I think as a rule, we know that newsroom staff tend to come from more urban areas, tend to come from higher income backgrounds than the populace at large. So it's possible, yeah. I can't say for sure, so I wasn't involved in the coverage, but it is definitely something that makes sense.
In terms of some of the follow-up reporting, there's a follow-up study done to the Kessler report, and some of the reporters cited talked about racism they experienced while out covering the presidential election, and that their reports of what they were experiencing and how the electorate was responding to candidates was different than something they've seen in the past. And some of them said that their concerns weren't taken seriously by their managers, that this was seemed like a minority experience, et cetera. But just wondering if that could play into our a lack of vision and anticipating just the popularity of certain candidates in the 2016 elections.
I think a lot of people were surprised by the election results. A lot of people that shouldn't have been surprised were surprised. And I think to the extent that when we talk about diversity in a newsroom, as Alicia mentioned earlier, we should be talking about a wide range of experiences.
Mm-hmm.
That includes people from different parts of the country, from, you know, different economic backgrounds, et cetera. Because otherwise, you will miss something.
Mm-hmm.
For sure.
Mm-hmm. Thank you so much to both of you. I really appreciated having this conversation this hour and appreciate your participation and willingness to talk about it. So thanks to you both. Luis, Luis Clemens is Senior Editor for Diversity at NPR News. Thank you, Luis, for being here.
Happy to be here.
And Alicia Williams-Boyd is the Senior Digital Director for USA Today Network in New Jersey and specifically Asbury Park Press. Alicia, thank you so much for joining us this hour.
Thank you for having me.
And as we close the show, just a reminder, if you'd like to check out the other stories by the teenagers who attended this year's radio camp, you can find them by searching the keywords NPR News and Radio Camp. And thanks to the Guthrie Theater for hosting them this summer.
This was a recording of a live radio show on NPR News. To add your voice to our discussion, you can call in at 800-242-2828 or tweet Kerri at KERRINPR. And if you miss us live, you'll find all of our shows by subscribing to this podcast. If you have questions, you can email us at talk@npr.org.